Welcome to the Hidden History Happy Hour podcast with Alex Dean and Brian Cunningham. Here we have a drink, have a laugh, and you just might learn something about our favorite stories from history.
Please visit our website at hiddenhistoryhappyhour.com and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you like the show, please rate us 5 stars and leave a review. Cheers.
Welcome back to season 2 of the Hidden History Happy Hour. Thank you so much to all of our hundreds, maybe thousands of new fans. And thank you especially to one special new fan, one special new addition to the Hidden History Happy Hour family, Mr. Henry. Do the rest of the names for me, Alex. We Americans don't have so many.
Henry Alistair Paul Dean, born on the 3rd of February.
That is amazing. Congratulations, my friend.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. You're first. And first of probably more than one, but tell us about it. Tell us how the name came about, first of all.
Well, we both like the name Henry very much. It's obviously a good English Plantagenet name, more kings than any other name. And Alistair and Paul are the names of his grandfathers.
Oh, amazing. And so you'll be calling him Hank, obviously.
We will be calling him Henry.
What if he wakes up like I did at 18 and wants to be called Hank instead of Henry?
Well, that'll be up to him, won't it? But and indeed, I keep saying him as if I've got a right to define his that person's gender, but we'll see. Brian, I couldn't be happier. I know you are well down this path already, but it's the joy of my life to be a father.
It's amazing. Congratulations again. How's the sleep?
Yeah, it's suboptimal, but I'm very aware, as with everything else in this process, that my wife is doing the heavy lifting. So the thing is, though, you can, with all of us at one point or another, being up at 2 o'clock or 4 o'clock or 6 o'clock, sometimes 2 o'clock and 4 o'clock and 6 o'clock, but not every night. Yeah. And it's the grind that gets you.
Well, this will be a lesson learned many years from now, like lots of things from more lessons of history. But I will tell you, when my daughters were little, and they're fully grown now, as you know, they both had, at one point in their infancy, terrible, terrible ear infections. And that's the worst, because whatever medicine you give them, if you don't hold them vertical, they're screaming and they're in agony. So you wind up having to hold them vertical all night long or until they go to sleep.
Oh, that's great. Funnily enough, my wife suffered from that as a child. So the chances are very high that that's going to be the case.
But here's, okay. Wait, hold on. Here's the sunny side of the story. I hated every minute of it at the time. I would put on music and I would literally dance with my baby in the living room. Right. And I hated it. But I look back now and those are some of the fondest memories I have. So sometimes the pain is the gain.
That's nice. I understand. Well, look, I mean, every day makes me happier than I've ever been. So it's great.
Thanks again. Congratulations again.
Thank you very much.
Can't wait to meet Henry. And I don't suspect this is true, but never rule anything out. Is it possible that this is the start of your attempt to have the most babies in London over the next decade?
What a great notion. My wife is not hugely, not completely on board with that notion right now. But, you know, Irish twins has a certain pleasant echo to it. It's only February. Well, let's see.
And it wouldn't be the first time, right?
Right.
Tell us about it.
I'm going to tell you the story of the great stork. We would say derby. You say a derby, I think. Yeah. The great stork derby. Charles Vance Miller was an eccentric. Indeed, lots of people are. He was also a multimillionaire, which is rather rarer. The combination gave us the story that I told in my book, More Lessons from History. And it's a story about a baby race, which was a thing. Miller was a prominent lawyer in Toronto. He dropped dead at work, age 72, without an heir. And that was in 1926. In his will, which is the point, he left the majority of his very significant estate in to the women, the woman, singular, in Toronto, who would give birth to the most babies in the decade after he died. This, by the way, was not his only testamentary wheeze. He had been president of a brewery, and he left his stock in it to prohibitionists. He had an estate in Jamaica, and he left that to three fellow attorneys who couldn't stand one another. And he said you can only have it in his will. He said you can only have this beautiful, valuable estate in Jamaica on the condition that you live there together. I mean, so three, obviously, yeah.
Three attorneys walk into a plantation.
Right. Right. So obviously he was a man of some humor. But anyway, the seemingly simple clause, leaving most of his estate to the mother who has, since my death, given birth in Toronto to the greatest number of children, was contested on just about every possible basis. The Ontario government tried to suggest it was void and the money should go to the state. His distant relatives tried to suggest that they should get it. But Miller was a lawyer. He knew what he'd been doing, in drafting terms at least, and his will held up. The Supreme Court of Canada, no less, and it's a great court then as now, found the clause to be valid. So the baby race was on. The prize would go to the Toronto mother, registered as having given birth to the most children by 4:30 p.m. on the 31st of October, 1936, 10 years to the minute after Miller's death. In the event of a tie, the prize would be split between the relevant mothers. And the prize was worth having. I point out, people will have picked up on the date already, but not only had Miller's investments done well, the Great Depression bit basically immediately after his death. So at stake was over $10 million in today's money. Cue the great Toronto baby-making race of 1926 to 36, the Stork Derby. The media was fascinated throughout. Papers from across the world breathlessly covered arrivals of new Torontonians. The Toronto Daily Star had a special reporter assigned full-time to the race. Imagine the job interview or the assignment. This is what you're going to be doing for the next decade. And lots of women started to stake their claims. As is the nature of this, you imagine it. Initially, the field is very wide. You know, locals enthusiastically throw themselves into this endeavor, banging out kids left, right, and center, and hopefully having some fun along the way. And obviously, having twins or triplets was a massive advantage. And such news would be seized upon with even more interest than usual. But obviously, ultimately, the claims of potentially contending families start to peter out after a mere five or six or seven children. And so you got towards the end of this decade, 11 families left, inverted commas, officially competing in the Great Stork Derby. As the deadline loomed, press interest grew to a fever pitch. And families in Toronto that were thought to be in contention were constantly photographed with their ever-growing broods, sometimes all together with their rivals. I mean, heaven knows how difficult a challenge that was for the photographers, and the photo shoots must have been rather noisy. But anyway, alas for headline writers, the story didn't have quite the climactic moment they were expecting, as the title was inevitably contested on multiple grounds. You can imagine, but I'll give you some examples of the disputes. What is Toronto? City limits? Greater Toronto? What's Toronto exactly? What about my child here, who hasn't been officially registered, but is definitely mine, I promise? Well, these are all actual examples of reasons to contest the contest. I had a legitimate child with another man, whilst having the other kids with my husband. And you know, I used to keep quiet about it, but now I know it might be worth millions of dollars. Can I please count that other child as well? And then, rather less humorously, but deadly serious in the contest, I had a stillbirth, or I had two stillbirths. How dare you not count those towards my otherwise winning total? And so on. So it was that just as the will itself had been dragged through the court system, the result of the Stork Derby was litigated as well. In the end, you get to 1938. The world is just about to have something rather more pressing to focus on. The result of this peculiar episode in Canadian history was ruled upon by a judge named William Edward Middleton. And rather pleasingly, I footnote this, that Middleton was himself the eldest of nine siblings. So he knew a bit about what he was doing. He declared a tie between one, Isabel Mary MacLean; two, Kathleen Ellen Nagel; three, Annie Catherine Smith; and four, Lucy Alice Timlett, each of whom had had nine children during the decade concerned, which I think is going some on any view.
That's impressive.
And each of those ladies received $110,000 apiece, which is around $2 million in today's money. Ka-ching.
Yeah.
From the pot, and he was a very fair judge, obviously, two other women got smaller amounts as illegitimate or unregistered or stillborn children were not counted by Middleton in the fecundity race. Do not blame me in reporting this. I didn't make the decades-old and rather ad hoc rules. I just report them. And my point is, at last, the Great Stork Derby was at an end. Despite the sensation that it caused and the questionable fame it brought to the millionaire, who would otherwise by now have been forgotten, such a competition has not been repeated to date, unless someone listening wants to tell me differently. And Brian, I found it tricky to draw a lesson from this one. I thought Miller was, on this evidence, a mischievous and calculating old sod. He must have known the scramble that this mad testament must inevitably go on to cause after his death, over a decade of people's lives. And he presumably, therefore, welcomed it. It smacks to me of him considering these poor families as his playthings, with children to come into the world for his posthumous amusement as they compete for his money. And yes, it won him a footnote in history, but it's not a very good one, is it?
No, and as far as we know, he wasn't some sort of, you know, we need more Canadians type guy either. It was just purely for the sport of it, sounds like.
Exactly. Just like messing with the three guys he left the place in Jamaica on the condition they lived together. He was just messing with people. But talk about the long game on messing with people. I tell stories about real villains in the book, and he's not an absolute out and out, you know, despotic villain, but in my view, he's definitely on the wrong side of the scales.
Yeah, there's a few things that jump out about this great and very timely, given your new arrival story. One is when you laid out the first part of the story and the interpretation of his will, I literally had PTSD flashbacks to my trusts and estates exam on the bar. That's exactly the kind of diabolical shit they're going to throw at you in these exams. Right. You know, there's a pregnant 80-year-old woman when nobody thought an 80-year-old woman could be pregnant. So that was the first thing. The second thing is, you know, it's diabolical enough, spiteful enough. And if you watch the what are those movies where your least favorite James Bond plays like the bumbling Southern detective? Very, very.
Oh, Benoit Blanc, Glass Onion.
Yeah, it's
they're pretty good.
Very good. It's one thing to mess with your own family. That's bad enough. But to mess with a bunch of people that you don't know, you'll never meet, you have no other idea what their circumstances are, pretty bad. So, no, he's not Goebbels, but, you know, I don't think he's he fits on the villain side slightly more than the hero side, right?
I agree. On your first caveat, you've taken me back to and I was a far less illustrious lawyer than you, but I recall in my trusts lecture, great John Hopkins teaching us, saying, giving the example of someone who left his estate to supporters of a football team.
Yeah.
And void for lack of certainty.
Yeah.
I'm an Ipswich Town fan. I open the newspaper. It says Ipswich won. I say good. It says Ipswich lost. I say pity. Am I a supporter? You know, do I get the money? So void for lack of certainty. And it's so interesting. Even when you think that something is as clear as having a child in Toronto, all of it's not clear. What's Toronto? What's a child? Yeah, does it mean your child? Does it be registered under your name? Sadly, stillborns count. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, well, this will, not to geek out, but this will give every law student and lawyer the same PTSD I had. There's a thing we call here, I guess you call it lack of certainty. We call it the rule against perpetuities. And basically what it means is you can't hand down property that you can't be certain where it's going to wind up, or that it is going to wind up with a certain person. And this is on every single law school and bar exam, and it's utterly frustrating and confusing, and everyone hates it. But this guy, I guess, was this guy a lawyer? Do we know? He wasn't,
right? Miller was a lawyer.
Okay, good. So he knew what he was doing. He knew he was messing with them. The next thing is, if this were happening today, it would for sure be a reality show on CBS or somewhere. And there would undoubtedly be mixing between these families and uncertainty about the father parentage of the kids. And that would be all the drama. This played out for 10 years though, in the newspapers, which is amazing. And then one kind of serious note, you know, you very wisely pointed out that this was all happening up until around the late 30s, when the world had more serious things all of a sudden to worry about. My worry is we're in that period right now. We care about Trump's golden shoes, and we care about the Taylor Swift conspiracy, and we care about what the Kardashians are doing. And meanwhile, we might just be slouching ourselves into World War III.
So I don't know about World War III, but I do know that, you know, Navalny was murdered by the Russian state shortly before we record this episode. As we go on air, his body has not, as we record this, he yeah. is, his body has not been returned to his family. His wife has speculated that's because they want time for the poison, Novichok or otherwise, to leave his body. Terribly unlucky, these critics of Putin, aren't they? Astonishingly unlucky. Indeed, after Navalny died, the news reached us, far less coverage for this, by the way, that a guy who defected to Ukraine and was rehomed in Spain made the mistake of getting in contact with an ex-girlfriend of his, I think, or with somebody from his past life. I think it was an ex-girlfriend, and has been shot to death in Spain in the days after Navalny's death. You know, and as you say, we find ourselves day to day looking at a good deal of frivolities while these really serious things are happening around us. So whilst I may not go with you all the way to, you know, nuclear apocalypse, I certainly am with you on the seriousness of our situation cloaked in ephemera and silliness.
Well, obviously, it's desperately to be hoped against. And I think the good guys still have a very good chance of preventing global conflagration. But I think the doomsday clock's a little bit closer to midnight than it was a year or two ago, unfortunately. And on that happy note, let me just give a book review recommendation.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of this book, but I'll put it in the show notes. That's why I was looking a little distracted. I was looking on my phone to try to find it. There's a John Grisham novel, famous lawyer, novelist in the US and around the world. Kind of run hot and cold on him. Some good of his books are amazing, like The Firm. Some are not as good. But he wrote a book kind of early on, I would say in the early 90s. And it was about exactly this. It was about some, as you call it.
That's the Testament. That's the Testament.
Yeah, Testament.
The guy gets someone to set up a video camera. Like, all the family are there. Every lawyer attests to his sanity. And he splits the will evenly between the relatives, and they go away. And he says to his lawyer, "Can you hang on 1 second?" His lawyer stays behind, says, "I've got now that they've all deemed me sane, I've got a new will. It's a single sheet of paper. It leaves everything to somebody no one's ever heard of." And he jumps out the window and falls to his death. The book itself is not great after that, but it's a fantastic opening.
Yeah,
The Testament. Yeah. I really like that one.
Yeah, it's a good book. And I'm a little, I'd say, more positive on the whole book than you are, because there's a whole Amazon treasure hunt.
Pantanal. It's in the Pantanal.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I like Grisham a lot. My favorite Grisham fact is that he said he was going to take a year off writing. And so he went and lived in Italy for a year, and he wrote a book off the back of it called The Broker. Objectively, it's a really weak novel.
That's not as good.
It's a brilliant guide to Bologna. And I went to Bologna in large part because of that novel. And I've walked the streets of Bologna. You can go to restaurants down streets that John Grisham guides you to in this tissue thin novel overlaying a kind of love song to Bologna.
Yes, a travelogue with a plot, a minimal plot at that. Well, this is a first, I think, for me at least, on the Hidden History Happy Hour, Alex, because I feel compelled, based on our story choices, to have not one type of cocktail, two types of cocktail. And I didn't realize I was getting myself into this when we picked these stories, but then I read the opening line of the second story and I realized I had to have handy the Kraken rum.
Yes, I have a bottle of that, and I put a very big dent in it shortly before Lent started, which we're now in, which is why I'm on alcohol-free beer.
Yeah, we Episcopalians don't care so much. But tell us the rum story, Alex.
Well, it's been a while since we had a tale of derring do and naval folk. Indeed. So as I exhorted people to do in the book, and as you are about to do, have a tot of rum and tuck yourselves in, because this is the tale of Operation Source.
It's the Kraken inside the Kraken, as our viewers can see. Go ahead.
Very good. Glass with the Kraken on it with the Kraken rum. German battleship Tirpitz was the pride of the Kriegsmarine. 2,000 tons heavier than her sister ship Bismarck, which was rather more famous, I think, thanks to adaptations made to her during wartime after she launched. And indeed, the Tirpitz was the heaviest battleship ever built by a European navy at the time. It was later just surpassed by HMS Vanguard. But anyway, it was there and thereabouts, biggest ship built by a European navy. And it was the subject of totemic pride in the Nazi war machine. Indeed, such was the status of the Tirpitz that Hitler's repeated personal interventions partially stymied her effectiveness. The Führer insisted that she not be exposed to danger, which plainly rather defeats the point of a battleship, and especially shouldn't be exposed to danger from aircraft carriers. And this meant that she was deployed less often and less effectively than German naval commanders would have wished. Nevertheless, she was... Yes, exactly. She was a powerful presence in calculations made by both sides, for reasons I'll explain. But there was this deadly fencing and probing going on as the Allies sought to bring material to Russia via the Atlantic convoys, and the Germans sought to prevent them. A, inverted commas, fleet in being is a naval force of such significance that even whilst in port, she changes enemy plans, tying up ships that might otherwise be fruitfully be deployed elsewhere in guarding against the risk of her sailing. And they change the balance of power in the arena they are in. Such was the Tirpitz. My point being, all in all, the Allies needed to get rid of her. Britain tried to bomb the Tirpitz several times, but defences were very strong in the Norwegian ports, which is where she was, and all we had to show for our efforts were lost Halifax bombers, which is not a resource you can get through too much if you're in the dire straits the Allies were in. So necessity, especially in war, being the mother of invention, we turned to a new capability, midget submarines. I gotta say, just that phrase means you've got to be crazily brave to get involved in these things, midget submarines. If something, anything goes wrong, you were all but guaranteed to be done for. Circa 50 feet long, the X-class midget submarines were towed behind normal submarines until they reached the area in which they would be deployed. Crews of three and later four men, the fourth person was a diver who was added in case you wanted to use a diver because we started to understand the capabilities of these things better. Three or four men in these to be going into these mini subs were transferred to them by dinghy when you were going to use them. They didn't have to be in there the whole time, not until you started to use them. They were on the main submarine. Anyway, we planned to use six midget submarines against the Tirpitz and other German ships berthed with her. But two sank on the way, one of them, incredibly bad luck, one of them with the loss of the crew that had just been transferred to it, underscoring the point about the dangers they posed and the requirement for great bravery. I take a moment in telling this to reflect on the deaths of those men who were no less brave than their comrades who continued to take on the Tirpitz. And I also take a cheers to their memory. And I also, cheers, I toast to the bravery of the men who carried on anyway. Right? They've seen their friends drown, slip under the waves before their mission's even begun. Those men gave their lives in the service of their country, dying in a tiny tin can off the coast of Norway. And they, those men who died on the way there are largely unremembered. So I'm glad we mentioned them here. So it was in the end only four midget submarines that went into the harbour in Norway under the cover of darkness that September evening in 1943. One X-class soon developed mechanical problems and had to turn back. So now we're down to three. And this wasn't actually as bad as it might have been, because whilst we didn't know it, unbeknownst to the British fleet and our intelligence operatives, the Scharnhorst that we were afraid of was out on exercises, which reduced the target list in the harbour. Now, midget or not, the ships were still spotted by the very alert German defensive provisions. One of them was promptly sunk by the guns of the Tirpitz. So we are down to two midget submarines. Both of those subs successfully placed their charges underneath the Tirpitz, but both were fired upon and crippled, and they were unable to escape. both crews remarkably survived, and they were taken prisoner by the Germans. Very soon after those brave soldiers were in German hands, their work bore fruit. Explosions tore through the Tirpitz, causing her to take on over 1,000 tons of water in exceptionally short time, and to list in the harbour. Much of her machinery and weaponry were damaged. I just pause for a moment to point out the men who were captured were standing on top of the boat that was going to explode. And if they weren't going to let down their mission, they had to say nothing about the mortal danger that they themselves were now in. And they said nothing. So the Tirpitz was very badly damaged, and repairs to her took more than 6 months. And not long after they finished the repairs, 6 months later, finally she was sunk by Lancaster bombers. By the time that she was sunk, by the way, we had lost no fewer than 38 aircraft in attacks upon her, which underscores, I think, the significance of the X-class attack. The work of a few men in a few tiny submersibles had crippled the pride of the German fleet for long enough to ensure that she played no meaningful part in the war before her end. It's rare that I directly quote people such as my pomposity and confidence in my own work, but I will quote Ludovic Kennedy, the journalist who wrote that the Tirpitz lived an invalid's life and died a cripple's death, which I think is very good. And finally, Brian, I note that the commanders of both of these successful X-class ships received the Victoria Cross. Lieutenant Donald Cameron, aged 27, and Basil Place, aged 22, and your gallant crews, the Hidden History Happy Hour salutes you. Bravo.
Thank you, gentlemen. Now, Alex, were these, much like your Calcutta light horse tale, was this capability kept secret afterwards, or were these guys allowed to pick up a little of the heroism recognition they deserve?
It was nothing like the Calcutta arrangements. Indeed, we wanted people to know if the Tirpitz was out of action.
Yeah.
The Calcutta Light Horse episode was clouded by Portuguese neutrality, which we didn't want to be seen to be violating. There was no such issue here. Of course, the Norwegian situation was rather different. The Norwegians took a very hard line on those who, that's why we have the term Quisling, they took a very hard line on those who had collaborated with the Germans. They were involved in the Axis efforts against their will. It was no offense to the Norwegians to have carried this exercise out. It wasn't the same level of security about it. Now, what I don't know is whether in the immediate months after Operation Source, we talked about midget submarines as opposed to bombers and air crew. That's a good question.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. It also reminds me, I don't know if we've ever talked about this on our show. I feel like maybe we have, but part of the Pearl Harbor attack on the U.S. on December 7th, 1941, was with Japanese midget submarines. They sent four or five, I think, and they all spectacularly failed. So they were not as successful as the Tirpitz attack.
I'm going to admit, I didn't know that.
Yeah, maybe we'll write about it. We'll see.
Great fact.
Yeah.
Great fact. That without stereotyping, it's obviously true, given kamikaze pilots and so forth. The Japanese had a particular attitude, certainly the Japanese culture of the Second World War, had a particular attitude towards expending human life and fanatical devotion. And that's on show with people who are willing to get into those. 1941, the technology was even younger.
Yeah.
Absolutely extraordinary.
I'm looking at the pictures of them. They look like something I built in my garage.
They're not high tech. One book I will recommend to you, it's not exactly a jolly read, but it's an interesting one. Hiro Onoda wrote a book called My 30-Year War. He's the guy who fought for 30 years on the island of Lubang in the Philippines. And just amazing what happened. They carpet bombed his island with leaflets personalized, addressed to him, asking him to surrender. And he didn't. He kept going. They had people come out and broadcast to him, like his sister and people he'd known at school, and say, surrender. And he didn't. What they did finally was get his commanding officer to go and order him to surrender on a broadcast. He still didn't. And then his commanding officer went, to bed that night because they were going to try the next day. Onoda broke into the compound. He's been up 30 years, right? He's been in the jungle for 30 years. Vaults over the security fence in this compound and steals into the cabin and wakes his commander up and says, they put you up to this, haven't they? It's not really true. And when his commander tells him it is, he salutes his commanding officer and hands over his rifle, still in working order, complete with makeshift bullets that he's manufactured from other things, and wept at the loss that Japan must have suffered. And when he was asked, why didn't you surrender when you saw these people? Did you not really think it was your sister? Did you not really think it was your schoolmates? He said, no, I believe that they were the people. That strengthened my resolve, because if Japanese people were still alive, then the war must be continuing.
So this would have been like the 60s or 70s, right?
Yeah, yeah, 45 to 70. I think it was actually 73, 74. But yeah. He surrendered in the early 70s.
Is this a film?
No, I don't think there's a film yet. Oh, well, there may be one in Japan. Don't know.
It's Tora 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 meets, what was that film with Tom Hanks and the soccer ball?
Castaway.
At Castaway, yeah. Amazing. Yeah.
I've seen pictures of him. So he was flown back to Japan. He was kind of shy. He didn't really like the publicity, but they took pictures of him at Narita Airport, which is an airport outside Tokyo. And he looks in incredible shape. Like, he looks younger than you would think. And in the end, he got sick and tired of people asking him for interviews, and he went off and became a cattle farmer in Brazil, South America at least, but I think Brazil. Anyway, the book contains depictions of how he hid himself and diagrams of how he would sleep at night on a slight incline so that he would wake up quickly if an attacker came. 30 years, Brian! 30 years of this.
Did he keep track of time? Did he know it was 30 years later?
He had a watch. I don't know, I mean, that might help him day to day. There were like three of others with him at the beginning. And one of them, two of them just properly sort of, one died and one gave up. And then one guy was with him for like a dozen years and eventually turned himself into the villagers on the island. And like, the bitterest part of this memoir is like that quitter, that lazy, good for nothing. It's 12, 15
stuck
years.
Stuck out for 20 years after the war.
Yeah, it's just extraordinary, the excoriation he visits upon this other guy who was with him. Anyway, he did it for like 30 years. And he had this incredibly healthy diet, nuts and berries. And he would forage and occasionally he would steal from the villagers. He was a massive pain and a danger to the villagers on this poor, humble kind of Filipino farmers and stuff on this island. But 30 years, incredible.
It is. It's also sort of incredible if he was, I mean, of course, I know the story. I didn't realize he made little raids into the village.
Yeah.
He would have seen something in the 50s or the 60s that would have told him.
It gets worse. He stole a radio, and it must have been battery powered because he obviously didn't have mains. But he stole a radio and he listened to reports of news, and the news would talk about how Japanese currency was doing, and it would talk about trade, and he believed that the world had come to a situation where commerce would continue even though countries were at war.
Hmm. Amazing. So back to the story, though, it reminds me of a couple of other things in addition to the Japanese midget subs. One is, you talked about during World War II, the Japanese difference of opinion about the value of human life. And you know who else has that is modern day Russia, who is just throwing convicts and unarmed civilians at the Ukrainian lines as cannon fodder. And it reminds me of the connection with the technology innovation of the midget subs by the British Navy in World War II to the now technological invention of the unmanned midget subs by the Ukrainians, which have now caused me to rename the Russian Black Sea Fleet to the Russian Bottom of the Sea Fleet. So right. It's amazing what kind of war drives innovation, right?
You've reminded me of a favorite old joke of mine, which is true. President Reagan's nominee to be ambassador to Italy was asked, not unreasonably, what do you know about Italy? He said, in the Senate hearing, and he said, I know that the boats in the new Italian Navy have glass bottoms so that they can have a look at the boats in the old Italian Navy. And he was confirmed. Yeah. It was a different time, right?
Boy, those were the days, huh?
Those were indeed the days.
Amazing. Well, two great stories. Great excuse to drink two different things. I'm hoping by the next time we meet, you will have had some sleep, but I doubt it. But don't worry. It will get better after at least 25, 30 years.
Oh, that's really reassuring. I couldn't be happier. Thank you, my friend. Good to see you.
Cheers. Till next time, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Hidden History Happy Hour podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you have questions, comments, or suggestions for topics, you can find us on Twitter or on our website, hiddenhistoryhappyhour.com. We look forward to joining you next time.
Much gratitude to our multi-talented production team of Jeremy Corr, Kate Cruz, and Grace Keller, and to our visionary executive producer, Ivan Williams. And thanks also to our art designer, David Wardle,
without whom this podcast would be, well, history.
Cheers.